This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me. This is a show that really allows us to have in-depth and meaningful conversations about topics that are so relevant for our lives. And that really is the purpose of What Women Must Know. It's to empower you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And as always, I have a great guest lined up today and an important conversation that we're going to be having. I always like to remind people, if you have not liked me over on my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, please do so, or my website, which is drcherylselman.com. You can opt in there, because either way, I will be posting all the archives of my shows that I do every week. And I have a second show on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Eastern Time called The Love Code. So if you haven't been listening to that show, you may want to add it to your list of must-listen-to podcasts every week. And that's more of a very spiritual orientation. And I have some very inspiring guests that help us to remind us how we are truly spirit connected to a place of love, of infinite possibilities, and creating the reality that we live in. So I hope you'll be joining me and listening in and visiting my website, visiting my Facebook page. Lots of great information gets posted on a regular basis as well. So let's talk about our topic. We're going to be shining the light on mental illness today, and my guest is Terry Shaney. And let me just say a little bit about Terry. She formerly was a successful entertainment attorney, and she now devotes her advocacy skills to the cause of destigmatizing mental illness. She serves on the board of directors of the Sachs Institute for Mental Health, Law, Policy, and Ethics, and is the honorary board of directors of the International Bipolar Foundation. She speaks nationally and internationally to diverse audiences ranging from Ohio to Dubai about her experience with bipolar disorder. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller Manic, a memoir, and her latest book is Modern Madness, an Owner Manual. So before I have Terry jump into the show, there's some really interesting statistics I just want to use as a preamble to our interview. So you may find this of interest. So people don't realize how common the widespread mental illness is, and Americans spend more money caring for their mental health than any other health expenditure, over $200 billion a year in the United States. And one out of five Americans is taking a psychiatric medication. And according to the World Health Organization, depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide. And that's just adults. Up to 20% of adolescents have a diagnosable disorder. And suicide rates, especially in young people, are exploding. And especially during this time with COVID and being locked in, locked down, we see an explosion of depression, anxiety, and suicides. So this is a very important topic, and I'm so glad that we have Terry on the show today. So let me officially welcome you, Terry, to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I really appreciate it. And those are shocking statistics, aren't they?
Oh, my gosh. They certainly are. It's horrible to have any sort of mental illness. You know, for me, there was a time early in my life when I suffered from depression, and I know what that's like. I mean, I would write, you know, I never was to the point of being suicidal, but I would be writing in journals, you know, just how terrible life was and how bad I felt, and it's a horrible place to be. It's a very dark, dark place to descend into. So, you know, I have, in my experience, been there, and I'm so glad that I'm not there anymore, but I have known it. I've been there. And you have such a unique story. I always find it so fascinating, Terry, how people start out in one direction in their life with their career to whatever extent they have their success and achieve their goals, and then something happens and their life takes them in a totally different direction that really moves them into a greater sense of purpose and passion and service to others. And that's certainly been your experience. So I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, to share a bit of your journey from being your successful entertainment attorney in LA to now being such a powerful voice.
Oh, thank you. Well, I did start out as an entertainment lawyer. I represented celebrities like Michael Jackson, Quincy Jones, all the major motion picture studios, and everything on the outside looked great. I just simply didn't understand what was going on with me because there would be entire weeks where I couldn't go to work. The same thing happened with school. I've had this ever since I was a young girl, where I simply couldn't go in, or I would hide under my desk. I would be crying all the time. But that would be followed by these incredible periods of productivity where I could get so much done, and I'd be so charismatic and energetic and just took on a ton of work. But then again, I'd fall into this black hole where I'd have all these huge outside expectations of my capacity that I couldn't meet. So it was very, very stressful. And the practice of law, particularly entertainment law, is stressful to begin with. There's a lot of screaming that goes on, unfortunately. There's a lot of money at stake. So I reached a point where I simply couldn't do it anymore. I attempted suicide, and I realized after that there was a reason I had survived, because I should not have survived my suicide attempt. But after a while, it came to seem to me like there had to be meaning to my attempt and my illness, and I was hospitalized after the suicide attempt for severe depression, and I started writing about this thing they told me I had called bipolar disorder, and I wrote all about the symptoms, and I researched it like a good lawyer, and I went on grand rounds with the doctors, and I got very good at telling the symptoms and the clinical information, but that just didn't seem to help. So I threw all that away and started writing about what it felt like in my own body and what I was experiencing from the inside out. And 7 years later, to my astonishment, I emerged with a book, and that was Manic, a memoir. And it shot to the New York Times bestseller list within a month. It was optioned by HBO and translated into 8 foreign languages, which just was such a surprise for your first book or any book. And after that, I realized my true path was in writing and witnessing what I have gone through so that other people don't have to suffer with such horrific pain.
So, Terry, can you give us an inside view of what it's like to be bipolar? And especially if you had this since a young girl, that it must have been a really scary time, because you never know when these cycles are going to appear.
That is the hardest part, the unpredictability. And I think people right now experiencing COVID-19 are getting a taste of what it's like to live with uncertainty day after day after day. I never knew what it would be like, or what I would be like when I woke up in the morning. Would I be eager to start the day? Would the sun be shining, the birds singing? Would I be just so thrilled to be alive, or could I not even move enough to get out of bed and take a shower? I mean, for me, depression is very physical, and it affects my entire, it paralyzes not just my will, but my body. So it was very hard to plan my life. You know, could I make scheduling with friends or with my work? I just simply didn't know how I was going to be day after day.
So, Terry, would those episodes, would they last for a short period of time, for a couple of days, or are they mm-hmm. longer durations when you were going through those various bipolar
sure.
up and down cycles?
Well, I have something that's called rapid cycling, and that means that my episodes are relatively very short. For example, my manic periods usually last about 4 days. The same with my depressive episodes. So in a way, although rapid cycling is very hard to treat because it's like chasing a tiger, you know, a comet's tail or a tiger's tail, you're just always chasing after the mood. My heart goes out to anybody who tells me they experience depression for months or mania for months. I can't imagine it.
So you had this since an early child. Do you have any idea either what initiated this dynamic in you or what would trigger these episodes? Obviously, it sounds like you lived with this cycling all the time and never knowing what was going to happen in these short periods of time. Because often with bipolar, there are longer periods of time.
Right.
It's so disorganizing to one's life, whatever the length of a cycle is. But, you know, periods of 4 days, you know, you can hardly manage to do
Correct.
Anything.
They varied somewhat when I was younger. I think as I've gotten older, the cycles have become shorter. But certainly, I think there's a genetic component. My mother had mental illness, and although she was never formally diagnosed, I know that they say, you know, it's part nature, part nurture. I had a loving family, and I certainly had everything that I wanted growing up except stability, unfortunately. But I did have a rather stressful childhood in that I was quite an overachiever. Part of that resulted from having these manic episodes where I was able to just really shine. I was always a straight-A student. I was a varsity cheerleader. I was valedictorian. You know, I had everything looked great. So I think my parents just didn't realize that what we called my spells, when I would just mm-hmm. not be able to get off the couch or move and just would be crying all the time, they didn't realize that that was mental illness. We just called it my spells.
So it's like ignoring a problem, right? Because you don't know what to make of it. You probably didn't even know where to go, you know, anyway.
And back then, it just wasn't talked about. And you certainly, you know, I came from a middle-class environment, and it was, I seemed so normal when it came to the measures that you measure children by, or you did back then, grades and socialization and things like that. I don't blame my parents. I think, you know, it would have been great if we'd been able to intercept this early. Early recognition of bipolar disorder can make a tremendous difference in the development of the disease. So I wish that would have happened, but it's something I've learned to live with and not blame them about.
Of course. So were you only diagnosed when you were hospitalized after that suicide attempt?
No, I had been diagnosed earlier when I was, when I was about 27 years old, I was diagnosed with major depression, and it wasn't until about 10 years later that I got the bipolar diagnosis. that happens quite frequently, that people don't get a proper bipolar diagnosis for many years because you don't show up at the doctor when you're manic. You feel too good, or you feel like you don't need any help. The doctor sees you when you're depressed, and I had good doctors, and they simply assumed I had major depressive disorder and treated me accordingly. What happened was that I had a very, very severe depressive episode and had electroshock therapy, which is called ECT, and it catapulted me into the worst manic episode I'd ever had. I say worst. At the time, it felt great. I went up to the Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur for about a month until I spent every single penny I had saved up. And when I came back home, we realized, okay, something more is going on than just depression. And that's when I was given the bipolar diagnosis.
Wow. All those years. And it was never identified. And I want to go and talk about what you've done as a path to bring you back into balance. But those manic states, people don't realize that when you're in that manic state, not only do you have this high energy, I mean, you probably didn't even sleep much, right, when you're in a manic state?
Oh, yeah, you don't feel like you need sleep at all. You can stay up for days. Sleep is the last thing in the world you want to do, because you have so many important things to do to save the world when you're manic. You just don't have
time. And you
have
so much energy, and you have the energy.
Right.
It's like you're running on this adrenaline. And do people find, I don't know if it was your experience, except, well, when you had that big manic stage, you spent all your money. But people can be reckless in that time as well, can't they?
Oh, you know, people think mania is so wonderful, and how do I get manic, and what's it really like? Well, there's a stage called hypomania in bipolar disorder, which I think most people confuse with mania. Hypomania is before you get manic, and you're just at the top of your game. You are so charming and charismatic and energetic, and your mind makes connections between all these things. It's wonderful if you're a writer. But that will cycle up quite often into mania, which is not as fun as you'd think, because you're very irritable, and you do think, your judgment just goes out the window. You do very reckless things sexually and with substance abuse and driving. And just you do things that you could never imagine yourself doing when you're in your more normal state of mind. Certainly spending all your money is a good example.
Which must have been absolutely horrifying when you kind of came back to reality a bit to discover what had occurred during that manic episode.
It's always, I think of it as, I remember when I came back down from Big Sur, I don't remember what I've done when I'm manic, when I'm really manic. My memory just disappears, and that's why it's so important to have loved ones and family who can keep you accountable. But I remember piecing together what had happened by the sales receipts, the very many sales receipts that I'd kept, and I mean, I bought the strangest things, like garden gnomes, you know, those little things you put in a garden. I didn't even have a garden. I bought a parrot cage. I don't have a parrot. You just do strange and unusual things, and you can't figure out why you did them afterwards.
Well, so what path did you take to bring yourself back into balance by addressing this, you know, having identified this pattern, this behavior, this imbalance going on within you? What was that path, and what has worked for you?
I have tried many, many things, and everyone, of course, every mind is unique and exquisitely different. So, you know, my path is not always someone else's. Medication has been very important for me. I think it is for a lot of people with bipolar disorder. Therapy has been essential. I'm still in therapy. And
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Therapy. So do you think that in your in the inner exploration you're doing and what you're coming to realize that some of the early life experiences have contributed to what has manifested as a bipolar condition? Is that what?
Yes.
Do you have any insight into that?
I think there was trauma in my childhood, mm-hmm. more than just the bipolar disorder, but I think that definitely had an impact on my cycling. But my reaction to stress throughout my life has been a huge trigger for my bipolar disorder, and that's been ever since I can remember. So learning how to deal with stress through therapy, cognitive therapy, EMDR, all sorts of different types of therapy has just been essential. Writing has helped tremendously. I highly recommend that people keep track of their moods. Just even if you just do a journal that keeps track of your moods, you're committing to recognizing your patterns. And that's something, educating yourself about yourself is really a lifelong goal of mine. And I think it's critical. That's where therapy has turned into, you know, just a lifesaver. Art therapy has been very helpful. I learned that in the hospital. Just, again, being creative. We're very lucky, bipolar people, to be unusually creative. There's a high correlation between creativity and intelligence when you're bipolar, which is great. What else have I tried? It's been really important to be sober. That was a journey I had to take, and I'm 20 years sober now, but I didn't realize that I was just, I used alcohol to self-medicate the depressions, and it also would make my mania higher. So I was always chasing this high with alcohol. And I didn't realize that my medications wouldn't work if I was drinking. That just, I know it says it on the bottle, don't drink with alcohol, but I just thought of that as a suggestion. You know, I didn't take it seriously. But once I got sober, my life really changed. And the medication started working. I became a better, more honest person, I think. So that's been most of the things I've done. Yoga is helpful. Mindfulness, I'm working on mindfulness and meditation. Mm-hmm. And also just having a team that surrounds me. My psychopharmacologist, who's the doctor that manages my medications, my therapist, even my my other doctors, we all sort of work together. They know what medications I'm on. They know what my health issues are. And having that sort of team approach has been really, really helpful.
I have a bunch of questions, but let me just ask, do you notice any side effects from medications that you need to be aware of?
I have to laugh at that because I notice nothing but side effects sometimes, it feels like. I have great admiration for people who stay compliant on their medications, and I do believe in medication compliance, but it's hard. It's still although there are more medications out there and they're better than they used to be, you really do have a trade-off with fatigue. For example, for me, fatigue is always an issue. There can be a certain amount of cognitive dulling where you just don't feel like you're as sharp as you could be. Sometimes that happened to me with lithium. Interference with sleep, you know, the really important things in your life that you need to be healthy. So it's ironic. It's a double-edged sword, the medications. I'm on medications that take care of the side effects of the medication. So it takes a lot of patience, and you need to work very carefully with your doctor. I highly recommend getting a doctor who specializes in psychiatric medications, as I said, a psychopharmacologist, because it isn't as much an art form as a medical choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine that's true. What have you learned about bipolar from delving into this world? What did you learn about what goes on? What triggers it? Can you give us some understanding of the mechanism that occurs that generates this response?
Well, physically, one of the things that triggers it will be a disturbance in sleep. If you don't get enough sleep, you run the risk of getting manic or just mood cycling. Mood cycling is always something you want to watch out for. You're really aiming for stability. So I think the thing that I've learned the most is that it's not volitional. I don't choose these symptoms. I have them, I don't choose them, but I can manage them. For the most part, not always, but for the most part, I am able to manage them.
So is it considered Go ahead.
Oh, I've also learned, just as you were saying in your introduction, just how incredibly widespread mental illness is. When I have finally come out of the closet and tell people that I'm bipolar, inevitably, almost every time I hear, so is my mother or my coworker, or so am I, you know, or I've struggled with depression, as you said yourself. And I mean, it moves me to tears almost how widespread the problem is. And yet it's, you know, the stigma still is out there.
Well, so has science come to understand what is going on in the brain, or what's going on in the body? You know, there's such a strong gut-brain connection. I think we're seeing more and understanding more of that. You know, it's not just chemical imbalance in the brain. It's a holistic journey. We need to understand how the whole system is creating an outcome or a symptom. What have you learned?
Yes. I've certainly learned that gut-brain connection is very important. And in fact, the doctor who takes care of my digestive issues is also a psychiatrist. So I learned it that way. I think as for what actually causes bipolar disorder, we really don't know yet. I mean, you can see, they map it out in the brain and see differences between a bipolar brain and a quote normal brain, but we still really don't know. There are theories about inflammation throughout the body being implicated, and I think that's an exciting new area of research, because I think stigma will be reduced when we're able to come up with a blood test or a, you know, a definitive chemical test that shows, yes, this is bipolar disorder. It's not all in your head, you know.
Right. It's, you know, could be all in your gut. And that
right.
That is the leading edge of what we're investigating,
right,
and understanding the profound role that our gut health has and how, you know, antibiotics and chemicals in our environment and in our food,
right,
and stress, and how everything is impacting the health of our gut and the microbiome and the gut lining. So that's a huge area that is, you know, there's so much research and a huge explosion of understanding and integrating all these systems, because we're not separate systems, right? Everything is impacting,
right,
everything. And,
I
you know when I was...
Go ahead.
Yeah, go. Yeah. No, you go, Terry.
No, I was going to say, that's what's so sort of frustrating for me, is that we, you know, the brain is an organ. It's a 3.5-pound organ. And why is it not thought of the same way as your liver or your pancreas? It just doesn't make sense to me that there is such stigma and such, you know, such a difference in parity of compensation, you know, insurance compensation. I don't understand why people don't see mental illness as brain illness, that is just another organ being,
yes,
affected by your other organs.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And what helped me to move out of the depression that I was,
mm-hmm,
struggling with for many years was, well, you know, I did a lot of therapy, and I was a psychotherapist,
right,
and probably got into it to help sort my, you know, my state out. And it was a lot of healing and looking at different traumas and birth traumas. There's so many factors that make us who we are and determine how we perceive and operate and function in the world. For me, I realized that I had a underactive thyroid. In fact, I discovered after many years that I had Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is an autoimmune condition affecting the thyroid,
sure,
right? So it's not even like,
sure,
the thyroid's the main problem. All autoimmune diseases start in your gut. That's why I'm so aware.
You know,
so I just want to say.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say what I had to do was to, in this journey to move out of this depression, I had to, you know, realize that I had damaged my gut early in my life, and you know, I gave up gluten, and I gave up sugars, and I gave up alcohol, and then I started to do a lot of gut repair with probiotics and really,
mm-hmm,
support thyroid. I actually never went on thyroid medication. I was addressing the autoimmune component of it. And, you know, as I did that and I made these choices and these connections, my state changed. And I became healthier.
Interesting.
And depression disappeared.
That's wonderful. Wow. Well, I do have a section in Modern Madness about the mind-body connection, because it is so profound. And I have a story about being diagnosed with hypothyroidism, underactive thyroid, and feeling so happy about it because it was a diagnosis that I didn't have to be ashamed of, you know, that everybody just sort of, you know, shrugged their shoulders at. But it was so important for me to realize that you shouldn't feel ashamed of the other diagnosis, you know, it's the same thing. And I've also noticed with nutrition that I've been on a diet called a low FODMAP diet, which I don't expect anyone to understand. It's for a condition called SIBO, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And my mood has been so much better since I've done that, cutting out gluten and sugar and, you know, the things that you think you can't live without. You feel so much better without.
It's such a profound journey as we discover these pieces of the control we have as we make changes,
right,
as we introduce, as we have an open mind and learn and are willing to implement, we discover how we can feel so different, how we can really take charge. I also wanted to ask you about the statistics for bipolar men compared to women. Is there a difference?
Well, no, actually, I think the statistics are the same for men and women. I think it's an equal opportunity illness, but more women seem to be diagnosed with depression than men. And I don't know how much of that is because more women are willing to talk about it and go in and get care, whereas men, you know, stereotypically, but men do try to be strong and silent, unfortunately, because the suicide rate for men is, I believe, is 4 times higher than for women. Although there has been some positive movement, I've noticed lately among the professional sports community, they're really stepping forward and talking about mental health, which is terrific. Just that every time you have someone come out and disclose that they're mentally ill, if they're an admired sports figure or a celebrity, it just really helps. And I wish more people would have the courage to do it.
Well, of course, in that industry, they have a big problem with chronic brain injury. So that has, of course, you know, they exploded as a cause, as a driver of depression, of suicide, of mental illness.
Yes.
The damage to the brain, and, you know,
particularly in football, yeah. I know the NFL is really devoting its resources to looking at that, which is great. They need to.
And I think just concussions, which many people can suffer from concussions if they have a fall or hit in the head or whatever, but we don't really appreciate how a concussion, if it's not addressed, if you don't take the right measures to help heal it with nutrition and rest, can actually cause moods to change and behaviors to change, because that can be a damaging effect that never gets addressed, right? So that's another thing.
That
and when it comes
sense.
To women, you know, I mean, there's always the emotional component for women who, you know, are so much more suppressed in many ways from expressing their needs. But our hormones are much more vulnerable to environmental changes, to emotional changes. And like that thyroid piece that you had and that I had really is so common. It is so common.
Yes.
So, yes, there's lots of dynamics that have to be explored. We're peeling back the onion skin, so to speak, and as you're discovering, just making some changes in your diet and addressing gut health can have a huge impact on supporting, you know, higher levels of well-being for you.
Yes, very much so. And I sort of fought the notion that nutrition was going to be a part of my healing process because it seemed like a very hard thing to do. I didn't want to give up some of the things I loved, but boy, the payoff is so great. You know, you don't feel deprived. You just feel healthier.
And it's so much worth it, right? It's the gold ring. And when you get when you put the discipline in and give it a go and you get the outcome, you know it's worth it.
Well, it's the same thing with sobriety. I mean, you think you're going to miss it, but you're so pleased by the how lovely it is to remember what you did last night that you really don't miss it as much as you think you're going to.
So tell us about your new book, which is Modern Madness, an Owner's Manual. What is it that you want to bring out to the public? What is the purpose of Modern Madness? What drove you to write this?
I really wanted to use my own personal lived experience, my own stories, and combine that with current medical research to give a fuller picture of what not just bipolar disorder but mental illness is like, what it's really like, what it looks like, and what we can do about it. And it was important to me to also reach out beyond just people with a diagnosis to family, friends, loved ones of people who are ill, because it is so stressful on them as well. And I, since Manic became a bestseller, I just have been inundated with messages from people, what can I do to help my loved one who's ill? And there's so much that others can do. You know, you can really save a life if you're willing to have the patience and the love to do it.
Well, what do you recommend to people who ask you that question?
Well, I have a particular cause. It's five little words. Tell me where it hurts. Tell me where it hurts. That's what I wish people would say when they are with someone with a mental illness and the person is suffering, rather than doing what we all do, and I do it too, which is try to give advice and fix it. The person does not want to be fixed. They want to be heard. Giving advice, even if it's good advice, you know, even if it's incredibly well meant, just can feel judgmental. And particularly if you're telling a depressed person to do something, they may just not be able to move physically, and it feels terrible. You feel guilty and ashamed, and it shuts you down. Whereas when you say, tell me where it hurts, the person opens up and they can start to express some of the darkness that's inside them. And it, if you expose darkness to the light, it dissipates somewhat. And it's not always easy. I have to warn people, as simple as that sounds, it can be very hard to listen to a person in pain, because depressed people don't see the world as a positive place. It can be very, you know, it can be very hard to listen, but I guarantee it, you will do your loved one a tremendous favor by just saying those five words and patiently listening, letting them know they're loved and heard.
And that sounds like it's always so important to listen, to just be curious,
yeah,
and ask how that person is experiencing whatever they're experiencing. Because I can tell you,
right,
one thing, trying to give people advice and tell them what to do to change will never work.
No, and we all do it. Watch yourself. The next time someone,
yeah,
says something's wrong, you will jump in there with advice. It is human nature, and I'm telling you, you just got to bite your tongue and really practice not giving advice. I used to run a mental health support group at UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute for 15 years, and I found it so hard to do, but so rewarding. The difference was amazing when you just elicit a person's experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's being really present with another person, which,
yes,
is healing in itself. There's a connection that is made when you can just tell me where it hurts and listen and give a space for a person to feel heard, which is something that's very rare in our culture. Everyone's telling everyone how they should do it, whatever,
yes,
right? But it's so rare,
yes,
to be taught how to communicate from a place of just being curious and draw out from another person their experience.
Right. Well, it sounds like you really understand it. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I learned that when I was doing relationship work and some of the trainings I've had with people. And one of the very simple techniques for relationships is just to mirror back what someone has said. They make a statement and,
right,
you go, okay, this is what I heard. And that's all you do. You don't give them advice or you don't tell them they're wrong. You just, and you find out if you actually heard them. And if not, you ask them to repeat the statement, and you have to then repeat it again and make sure that you are repeating what they said so they feel heard. And that in itself is a big piece of healing relationships, because people don't feel heard.
Right, right. They feel judged, mostly.
Yes. And then we get defensive,
and
then we,
yes,
you know, close
and
down
so
and
ironic,
argue, right?
it's so ironic because all people are trying to do is help. You know, the heart is in the right place, but the ears aren't working.
Well, we have never been trained. We haven't been taught.
Right.
We haven't been taught. You know, it goes all the way back to childhood where, you know, that kind of conversation never went on either. It was always, telling kids what to do or assuming you know what they're talking about instead of sitting down and going, well, tell me how you feel. Tell me what you're experiencing. Yeah. I mean, that's what I learned from these teachers. It's like it's rewiring the brain, Terry, literally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly what it is, rewiring the brain.
Mm.
And the
so
behavior.
Let's talk about, I want to talk about suicide because I know that that's a really big topic going on right now with COVID. You have some statistics here about suicides that's pretty scary. Let's see if I can find them. What are they? Do you know have that? Do you have? Can you pull those?
Well, I know that
suicide.
We were having an epidemic of suicide. It was called before the pandemic hit. So the suicide rates had just skyrocketed, and I think a couple statistics that stick in my mind are that another person dies in America every 40 seconds, if you can believe that. From suicide.
Wow.
And also something really stunning that, again, just stuck in my mind in my research was that in the last 15 years, the suicide rate for young Black women has gone up 182%. 182%.
Wow.
I can't even get my mind around that. I mean, people of color, we are not winning the battle there. There's such a need for what they call cultural competence among healthcare providers, and we just don't have it. You know, people who are of the same background, understand what the community is like, what the community, approach to mental health is. And it's really something I think COVID has shown us, the healthcare disparities physically, but they exist mentally just as strongly, if not more.
Why do you think suicide rates have gone up during this COVID period?
I think that it's the uncertainty. That's my theory. I think my therapist had a wonderful phrase, which is that human beings can stand anything so long as it's time limited. We just don't have any sense of certainty here, and we're getting direction from all different sides that's confusing, and we're not equipped to deal with uncertainty well. And you combine that with anxiety and depression, and you've got a perfect storm.
And I'll just throw something in here that I've been learning. So when people are confined, what do? They watch a lot of things on television or spend a lot of time on their computer, right? And it's something that you may not have been aware of, Terry, but that I have been learning and studying. But the blue light that is emitted from televisions and computer screens and your phone screens at night is a disruption. The blue light, which goes directly through the eyes into the brain, is a disruption of key circadian rhythms, which throws everything out of whack. And leads to deficiencies, it leads to nutritional deficiencies, it leads to brain dysfunction and depression as one of the symptoms, which is one of those factors that we, you know, it's kind of a blinding flash of the obvious when you learn about it because we're surrounded by blue light at night.
Right.
I mean, that's blue light is what you get in midday, but when you get it at night, especially from the screen, that frequency actually is totally unnatural. It's totally unnatural.
That is really scary.
Isn't it?
Very scary. Yes.
Yes. Yes, and it's something that you may even want to check out, or I can send you some information, because we're finding that that upsets the production of melatonin and it creates insomnia. It mood alters in a negative way. It has many consequences, and you know, so it's recommended to change the color of your screen. It's recommended to use blue blocking lenses, glasses at night. There are some strategies that are really critical, because the consequences from this unnatural light at night is incredibly disrupting to our natural rhythms, and depression is one of those symptoms.
The there's research going on right now suggesting that really bipolar disorder is a disruption of circadian rhythm. So I find that so interesting. I'd love to know more about it and what I can do to protect myself.
Yeah, you know, it's a combination of protecting yourself and also the importance of getting natural light, because we're indoor creatures now, and we don't understand the role of light, especially early in the morning with sunrise or frequencies of the light at night, to sunset, are critical for our evolutionary process of setting circadian rhythms in proper motion. And if we're indoors all the time.
I did use a light box for some time when I was having very, very bad depressive episodes, and it helped to do that in the morning. I should dig it out. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's an alternative, but it's much better to get out there early in the morning at sunrise, because it's those frequencies of the sun that's communicating through the eyes directly into the brain, setting all the circadian rhythms of every single cell into proper harmony, which is something I have learned and I do. Yes. So, you know, these are blinding flashes of the obvious, you know, going back to nature and how we've become so, you know, we're so disconnected, right? And we live indoors and we're glued to our computer screens and our televisions with this blue light, not to mention the EMFs going on. All are having an impact on us. And unless you are curious to learn more, you wouldn't suspect that that's a driving force.
And you're right. I think that in COVID, we are, if I'm any example, we are surrounded by our screens right now, more so than at any other time. So that's scary and really interesting to me.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's our screens, it's the LED lights in our homes, in our street lights. It's kind of like unintended consequences.
Everywhere.
Yes, yeah. So there are things to do, there are strategies that we can implement. But, you know, I just want to say, as we're coming to the end of our fascinating conversation, and I so appreciate your candidness about your journey, Terry. As a naturopath, I always am curious about what other natural alternatives, and I just want to let people know, if they're dealing with a mental illness or someone in their family, the other thing to also investigate is the nutritional component, and to investigate the orthomolecular psychiatry side of things. I don't know whether you have done that at all, but that has been really successful for many people. There's, you know, there's no magic bullet. And I think you would agree, there's no magic bullet. So you got to find what strategy works for you. But you got to be open to look at all of the contributing factors, even as crazy as it sounds, the blue light off of our computer screen as being a trigger. It's like one more trigger to imbalance in our system.
I call them my mooring lines, M-O-O-R-I-N-G, all the things that I do to try to stay balanced and sane. And it takes a lot of them. It doesn't just take one. There is no one answer. It's just a host of things that you have to do to really stay in balance.
Yes, it's a discipline to live your life mm-hmm. as fully as you can for any of us, whether you have a mental illness or you're just, you know, a little crazy with life. We're
right.
all kind of dealing with our crazinesses. But it's a discipline, right, to bring ourselves into balance.
But
that's the challenge.
The joy of that, I mean, discipline has sort of a bad connotation maybe to some people, but the joy of it is that you feel some sense of control. And when you have bipolar disorder or mental illness, you don't feel very in control a lot of the time. And just knowing that there's things that you can do to prevent recurrences and make yourself feel healthier, I mean, it's really, it's just a blessing that there's as much information out there as there is.
So I want people to know that you have a wonderful website called Terry, T-E-R-R-I, Cheney, C-H-E-N-E-Y.com. We have a minute or so left, Terry. Is there anything that you just want to add before we have to wrap up this really empowering conversation?
Well, I think I'd like to just encourage people to educate themselves more and more about mental illness, because it really is, as we've said a couple times in our conversation, bigger than we realize and more common. And it's like if you were dating a French girl, you learn a few words of French. You know, it's the same thing for loved ones. If someone you know has mental illness, you know, get to know some of the vocabulary and the symptoms, and you can do so much good. You can. My life has been saved so many times by other people, and I really want to just stress that it's not hopeless. It really is. The solutions are out there. It's just a matter of persisting and having patience.
Right. Well, I want to thank you for all the great work you're doing in this real service to all of us and to the greater community around the world. And the courage to speak your truth. And you know, the wounded healer is the most powerful person in the world.
What a lovely phrase. The wounded
right?
healer. I love that.
Yes, feel free.
Thank you. I'm writing it down as we speak.
because you're authentic then. You've been there. You've been through it. You share about it. It's like you are moving through it all. And can share your experience because you're authentic. You embody that journey. You're not just talking about it. And
right.
that is what connects, and that's what heals. So I just really appreciate everything you've done and really honor the courage to speak out and to
Aww.
Really have an impact in the world, Terry. So especially in
well,
this
thank
world.
Thank you. Thank
you're
so you
welcome.
So much. That's marvelous to hear.
I really honor you and recognize that, you know, that the courage and the warrior in you to take this on.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're all very grateful to you because of what you've chosen to do with your journey.
Well, and I think it's exactly what you're doing. So I appreciate the compliment from you. Thank you.
You're so welcome. And to all of you listening, thank you. Please share these conversations with your friends. You know, we want to be able to get more and more people inspired, uplifted, and transformed. So hope you'll be joining me again every week. And until next time, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.